Hi, and welcome to SpondyCast, where we bring together the best medical minds, thought leaders, scientists, patients, and caregivers to inform and inspire the spondylitis community. I'm your host, Jill Miller, living my best spa life, knowing that how we meet today has the power to change everything going forward. Please note that the information provided in this podcast should not be considered medical advice. We do encourage all listeners to consult their healthcare professionals for medical concerns. Thank you for listening, and we hope you find our discussion today enlightening. Hi, and welcome to SpondyCast. Today, our guests are Dr. Alan Lee and Dr. Prashant Singh. We're going to talk about spondyloarthritis in the gut, the role of diet on the gut microbiome, and its potential to improve inflammation. Let me introduce our guests today. Dr. Alan Lee is an assistant professor of medicine at the University of Michigan. His research and clinical interests involve studying diet-microbiome interactions in irritable bowel syndrome and inflammatory bowel disease. And Dr. Prashant Singh is an assistant professor of medicine at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. His research interests include understanding the role of diet and microbiome in the pathophysiology of disorders of the gut and brain access. He is currently supported by the K23 Career Development Award from the National Institute of Health, and grants from IFFGD and MNORC. He has authored more than 90 clinical and translational research articles and reviews appearing in top-tier scientific journals. Thank you both for joining us. How are you today?
Doing well. Thank you for inviting
us. Thank you for having us.
Excellent. Okay, so we're going to talk about the gut, which is a hot topic for sure. And always questions, I think, for people with AxSpA and growing. So I think maybe can we start with Dr. Singh and tell us a little bit about your background and why you wanted to focus on the gut and diet in your research?
Yeah, so I'm a gastroenterologist by training, and I specialize in disorders of gut-brain interaction, which or DGBIs, which includes things like IBS, gastroparesis, and chronic constipation and motility disorders. And a lot of our patients already kind of make that connection that the symptoms are worse when they eat certain food, or the symptoms are better if they avoid certain foods. And our patients in general are very interested in dietary therapies and have lots of questions around it. And unfortunately, we don't really know how diet impacts microbiome, how their interaction impacts the gut lining in general, and obviously cause symptoms. So that set me off the path of trying to find and learn more about it.
That's awesome. Dr. Lee?
Yeah, so like Prashant, I'm also a gastroenterologist, also interested in studying DGBIs like IBS. And I think we've known about this connection with the microbiome in conditions like IBS for some time now. There was this outbreak of E. coli that occurred in Walkerton, Ontario in 2000. And a lot of people in that community ended up getting sick. And they found that about a third of these people in this community ended up developing this post-infection IBS. And it's something that in some people, unfortunately, can linger for many years. And then, as Prashant was saying, diet is a really hot topic in IBS, and there's a lot of patient interest in developing dietary therapies to treat their symptoms. And we know that diet is one of the major modifiable ways that we can modify our gut microbiome.
So for people who might be new to this topic, can you explain a little bit about the gut microbiome, why it's so important, and what it means to our overall health?
Sure. So just a brief definition, the microbiome is the community of microorganisms living in or on our body. We have different microbiomes, so the gut microbiome is the one that has been the most characterized, which are the community of microorganisms that live in our gut. And we know that this gut microbiome contributes to our overall health and to gut function. So one example being when we eat, some of these carbohydrates called resistant starches are not digestible by human enzymes, but the microbiome, because it's co-evolved with us over millions and millions of years, have developed this ability to digest these resistant starches, and they form these compounds called short-chain fatty acids. And one of these short-chain fatty acids is something called butyrate, which we know is an important cofactor in the colon. So it's one of the major energy sources for colonocytes, which are the cells that line the colon lining. And butyrate also helps to strengthen those the barrier between those colonocytes. So we know that many of the metabolites and function of the microbiome can potentially impact human health.
Yeah, it's incredible where we've come from. I mean, I can remember 30 years ago, we never talked about this other than go with your gut, right? Dr. Singh, maybe I'll ask you that, like, a lot of people, particularly in our community living with spondyloarthritis, report GI issues. Can you talk a little bit about what we know about the link between gut health and spondyloarthritis or similar conditions?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I think we know that there is a known connection between patients with spondyloarthritis, such as ankylosing spondylitis, and IBD, that is inflammatory bowel disease. About 10% of patients with ANCSPON or ankylosing spondylitis have underlying IBD, and up to half can have this subclinical gut inflammation where they don't have overt symptoms and overt inflammation of inflammatory bowel disease. But if you look under the microscope, there is still more than normal inflammation, suggesting that they maybe have a shared pathophysiology, that they have these two conditions are related together and implicating the link of that maybe the microbiome is a driver of both of these conditions in genetically predisposed individuals.
And when you say subclinical, what does that mean?
Yeah, so subclinical means that it's not giving you symptoms, but it's there, right? So it doesn't mean that it's going to give you symptoms or it's never going to give you symptoms. It just means that there is inflammation in the lining of the mucosa, but it's not enough to give you any symptoms right now. You can probably have symptoms in future, or in some people, the body is able to control it and you might not have symptoms, right? Okay.
There's a subpopulation of people, like when Prashant and I do colonoscopies, occasionally we'll see people who come in for a screening colonoscopy with no symptoms. And lo and behold, we find inflammation and they probably have underlying inflammatory bowel disease, but they're just asymptomatic at that time. And some of these patients never get symptoms.
And what about, I'm going to go off script here for a sec, but what about on the flip side where you've got patients who have symptoms for a very long time, but when you do the colonoscopy, there's nothing there. And I know this is the experience. I've talked to a number of patients who were diagnosed, including myself, who had GI symptoms for decades with no clinical diagnosis, was finally diagnosed with ex-spy, began the biologic journey and have not had the GI issues since. And mm-hmm. And it was interesting. I talked to the doc that was my gastro for a decade and a half, and I saw him recently and I said, you know, I got diagnosed with ex-spy, and he was like, I missed it. He's like, mm-hmm. I missed it. And it was 13 years of complaints. And I think there's a large population out there that feels like they have a lot of symptoms that when they get to a rheumatologist, then get diagnosed. And I'd be curious, like, your thoughts there, because I know IBS is something that we we haven't fully pulled under the umbrella that there is a direct link.
Yeah, I think those are great points. So there's several layers that we can try to tease out here. The correlation between symptoms and inflammation is actually fairly weak. And you know, you mentioned IBS, which is kind of the prototypical syndrome that we see where people have these, you know, terrible symptoms, but there's no overt inflammation that we can see by colonoscopy or radiology testing. Prashant and I are also studying this group of inflammatory bowel disease patients whose inflammation is controlled, something that we call quiescent IBD, but they continue to have symptoms despite their inflammation being under control. And so that's something that we're particularly interested in studying and trying to understand what's driving these symptoms. And then there's some patients who, you know, their symptoms may precede developing overt inflammation in the gut. Yeah. And so some of these patients may get misdiagnosed as IBS when in fact they probably have underlying inflammatory bowel disease that just hasn't manifested yet.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And we're going to talk about research in a minute, but I'll put a plug in that this is probably why we need more research dollars going to very good universities. Okay, so we sort of sorted out the SPA links. Gut inflammation and gut dysbiosis. I think if you're on Instagram any time in the last 2 years, this is a very hot topic. But how can you explain a little bit about what they actually mean and how they relate to chronic inflammatory diseases like SPA?
Yeah, so I can start, and Alan, feel free to jump in. But the first concept is gut inflammation, right? So inflammation means, in very simple terms, inflammation means when your immune system is active or is angry, I should say, right? Your immune system is responding to something. It's not a bad thing, right? That's how we get rid of infections in the GI tract. That, like, you know, if you get a bad infection, generally you get symptoms because there is inflammation in the GI tract and the GI tract is responding to it. And it's trying to control it. But sometimes it gets out of control. Or sometimes the inflammation starts without an acute infection, but there might be some changes in the microbiome, which the lining is not very happy about, and then immune cells get active. So what is happening is there is either infiltration of immune cells in the lining or their activation, which in turn just causes irritation in the lining, and that's what we call as inflammation. And you can sometimes see it under the microscope when you take biopsies. Sometimes you can just, it's so bad that you can see them under endoscopy. Like, you put a colonscope, I'm like, I don't have to biopsy this to know that there will be a lot of inflammation because this looks red, this looks angry, this looks ulcerated. And sometimes everything looks fine and it's only under the microscope, then you can see the inflammation. And sometimes another layer to this is that there are cells which we can't read under the microscope, like mast cells, right? Like, mast cells are a typical example. We generally, if you look under the microscope, you can't tell that there are mast cells there, but they are there. They just require special stains. So you can miss that inflammation, right? And think that there is no inflammation, but these are the mast cells are the ones driving it in some patients. So there is a lot of layers to it. The most gut being like where it is, right? It's a place which it's in constant interaction with microorganisms, so bacteria, viruses. So what dysbiosis actually means is the change in the microbial community from a healthy state to a not so healthy state, and it there is no definition of the this much of this bacteria, this much of this bacteria, this much of that bacteria is what defines healthy. It's very different for people. But if your microbiome is so far off from this axis, healthy axis, that it's causing irritation or inflammation or just symptoms, and that is what we call as dysbiosis.
So it's a little bit like the state of dis-ease, not disease, but dis-ease versus ease, right? Like, okay, for any, I think we're learning more and more people are individuals and everybody's a little different. So, okay, so I want to talk a little bit about diet. And maybe we can get into supplements a little bit. I think I personally find, and I think a lot of people do, there's like this overwhelming confusion about what is the right thing to get our gut microbiome. I know there's a general rules of thumb on diet we want to work on. And one of the things I believe our community here struggles with is you go along and you're sort of in a state of management of the disease. You hit a flare, which may include gut issues. How do you determine what the diet looks like in a management state and in maybe a flare state? I have an obsession with trying to keep the acute from becoming chronic, or to help people do that, because I think then you spiral in. But there is overwhelming, like, we'll call it marketing information out there on what the right approach is. And I know a lot of people spend a lot of money and time and sort of banging their heads trying to manage the gut biome essentially toward health. So thoughts on, dietary patterns, and then where do you go when you're, what do you prioritize when you're struggling in a like an acute phase of the disease?
Yeah, you raise a lot of good points there. So one, there's a lot of information out there about specific diets. And it's really hard to parse through all of these diets and see which one would be best for each patient. That being said, to my knowledge, I don't know that there's great data on diet in spondyloarthritis specifically. So we may have to extrapolate data from conditions like irritable bowel syndrome or inflammatory bowel disease, but we don't have hard evidence in spondyloarthritis specifically. And then secondly, you mentioned ways that we can use diet to try to prevent disease or maybe even inflammation. So there's actually very good data now that healthier eating patterns probably does reduce the risk for conditions like inflammatory bowel disease. And so some of this is epidemiologic data. So, you know, inflammatory bowel disease typically has been a disease of Europe and Northern America, and the rest of the world really had very low incidence of this condition. However, in the last probably couple decades, that has changed markedly. So now some of the areas of the world where the incidence seems to be rising most rapidly is places like Asia, Africa, and Latin America, where this condition really was pretty rare before. And then in addition, we've also seen that as people have shifted away from traditional diets to more of a Western style diet, that seems to also track with their risk for diseases like inflammatory bowel disease. And so what we can try to extrapolate from that is, trying to get to a healthier diet. So eating more plant-based foods, less processed foods, less high fat foods, those are things that probably does reduce our risk for diseases like inflammatory bowel disease.
Yeah, I take your point there. And thanks for breaking down and synthesizing my multi-layered question. But it's also, I was in the UK last week, and every time I go, there's more processed food on the shelves. And I said to my colleague that, you know, it seems like it's faster, but we're probably going to anticipate like more of our diseases just showing up there, right? It's unfortunate, and it's tough too, right? It's this balance of like, we've created a world where we want to be efficient and effective and busy and keep moving, and at the same time I see a future where we may be decreasing our life expectancy just because we're so efficient. So do you have a specific diet you would recommend to someone just to start, or foods just to, so let's go with start and prioritize around somebody who might be with SPA or a similar disease.
Well, we know from the IBS literature that this low FODMAP diet can be helpful for IBS symptoms. So these are things like specifically abdominal pain and bloating, and maybe less for diarrhea or bowel dysfunction. And I'll back up. This low FODMAP diet basically is an acronym for these fermentable oligosaccharides, disaccharides, monosaccharides, and polyols, which are these poorly digestible carbohydrates that can make their way to the colon. They get metabolized and fermented by our gut microbiome, and that could potentially cause these symptoms like pain and bloating in patients with irritable bowel syndrome. And so in patients with IBS, what we'll do is they'll go through this regimen where they'll remove these FODMAPs from their diet for a period of time. And then they'll go through this process where they reintroduce these FODMAPs to see if they can identify triggers. And then they have this longer term personalization phase where once they've identified triggers, they can reintroduce many of these FODMAPs that don't cause them symptoms. And this is very evidence-based. There's several meta-analyses now that have shown that this low FODMAP diet is better than habitual diet or even control diets. But again, we don't have data in patients who have spondyloarthritis that this diet is helpful.
I would just add that that low FODMAP data, as Alan is saying, is all about symptom control. So if somebody has active inflammation in their gut, right, like let's say you got scoped and you have active IBD, which is common in patients with spondyloarthritis, this diet is not going to get rid of your inflammation, chronic inflammation. So although it's good for symptom management, once your rip-roaring inflammation is controlled, there is no data at least that this controls chronic inflammation and brings the disease into remission.
That's a great point, Prashant. I did not mention that. The slow FODMAP diet is completely for symptom control.
Yeah. Oh, interesting.
And I would add one more thing to this, that Jill, were mentioning about an acute phase and a chronic phase, right? And I think it is important for us to realize what are we trying to target, right? For, as Alan was mentioning before, and we were chatting, that ultra-processed food, we know are harmful for gut lining because it destroys the barrier, it sensitizes the nerves and causes inflammation. But, and there is good data that whole grains, legumes, fruits, vegetables, all the things we are running away from are actually very beneficial for gut bacteria and in reduces risk of IBD as well as other conditions, right? So if you, for example, if you have a family member who has spondyloarthritis or IBD or both, and you are worried that I might also have it, but you don't have that, then I think, and you are trying to do something to modify your risk, because you have seen your family member suffer, then maybe trying those dietary strategies to prevent that inflammation in the gut might be a good place to start. Unfortunately, if you have been just diagnosed with spondyloarthritis or active IBD, then these f- foods, again, although very good, are very fermentable because they're generally often very rich in what Ellen was mentioning as FODMAPs. So for that acute phase, it's hard to suddenly change your diet when you are in a lot of inflammation. But once the inflammation is controlled, then you can go back into, like, you know, to keep maintaining it, maybe is another way of using these approaches so that you can have a healthier lifestyle going forward, at least.
No, that's great. Can we talk about fiber and the gut?
Sure.
So I think there's, right, there's good evidence, and you guys can tell me more, that fiber is something we want to focus on, I think, and we don't get enough as Americans. But I also want to talk about the way that, like, I think a lot of people just go to a smoothie or they pre-chop the fiber. And is there benefit to eating like the whole food, even not even just putting it into like a shake or a smoothie or taking a fiber pill or a psyllium husk pill? Like, what is the good best rule of thumb or best practice for our bodies when it comes to fiber?
Yeah, I would say that you're right. I think we as Americans don't get enough fiber. That's for sure, right? Like, an average intake is somewhere around 15 grams to 20 grams and recommendations around 25 to 35 grams. So we are way short of what is the recommended allowance for fiber and what we actually get. And this is just not true for only US, but a lot of Western countries, right? And I think that is definitely a question, is that how much of this risk that comes with ultra processed food is coming from emulsification and how much is coming from just them not having fiber, because fiber is the first thing which goes away when you start processing the food, right? And that's very important to tease. But I think you're right. There is absolutely no downside to naturally increasing fiber in your diet. We're not talking about like 70 grams of fiber a day, but like, you know, just the recommended amount. If you can just reach the amount that's recommended, is probably the best thing you can do for your gut. And I couldn't agree more that whenever possible, you should do it in the natural ways and not through supplements. And that's something I keep telling my patients. I'm like, if you could do it naturally by working with a nutritionist or a dietitian, that would be great. As much as I prescribe fiber supplements, I would love to not prescribe them because I would love for people to get it naturally. And agree, right? Like, if you could get it from whole grains, from fruits and vegetables, raw fruits, or even cooked fruits and vegetables, that's obviously is better than smoothies. But again, smoothie is better than no smoothie. So right, we will take whatever you give, right? If you're
right.
Like, you know, I can only do a smoothie. Don't, if that's the first step you're ready to take, please take that, right? That's still a step forward in some direction.
Yeah, I like it. And the function of fiber is really to, like, it almost is like, does it, I mean, I know it's heavy and weighty and moves things through your system, but it also kind of cleans, right? Is that?
Yeah, it has multiple layers and right. Like, first, your colon actually just cannot move without fiber. Fiber is kind of right. Essential for your colon to move. I treat fiber as the fuel or gas for the engine. If you think of your colon or GI tract as the engine, like, fiber is the gas which is driving this. Like, it will not move until you give it fiber. So a very common cause of constipation, and that's actually why constipation is so much more common in Western countries than in Asian countries, because we just don't eat enough fiber, right? So it's motility. Second, I think, as Alan was mentioning before, fiber is the basis of our beneficial relationship with bacteria, which has evolved over millions of years. They're not living there for us. They don't really care about us. What they care about is the fiber we eat, because that's what they ferment and grow on. And then in turn, they will give us the energy molecules which our colon uses for maintaining our gut lining and health. So fiber is essential for maintaining the barrier that is preventing like bad stuff from reaching the inside of our body. And then also it's essential for maintaining that gut microbiome in a healthy state and not in a dysbiotic state. So it serves like a lot of functions.
Fiber is funny too, because we use it for both patients who have diarrhea and constipation. I mean, it has that interesting paradoxical effect on people who have this bowel dysfunction in both ways. So yeah, fiber is a little bit of a magical food for our gut.
Yeah, it's one of those, as a mom, I'm always like, and we do try to approach like my kids as if they would have spa, right? And their diet and everything. And they, you know, anything they say, I'm like, are you eating enough fiber? Are you drinking enough water? Like those are, I feel like, the two questions we have to talk about. And I think on one other episode we talked about, like, if people would just talk about poop, we would be like way better off as human beings and way healthier. Okay.
Well, so I'm like a parent of a 4-year-old and I'm obsessed with my kids' poop because like I cannot, yeah. I think I daily like do fiber counting. I'm like, did he eat fiber today? Did he not eat fiber today? Like what, like when was the last time he ate veggies, right? Like did I pack veggies in the lunch today or should I give it now? Like, you know, so it's, and it's funny, right? Like you should obsess, I think, right? And I think it is part of the reason of actual parenting. I feel like as we do, once you start introducing these things to them, they develop healthy lifestyles, which are going to last their entire life, right?
Yeah. Well, and I think, yeah, you look around and you're like, you wake up in the morning and if the first thing you do is like, okay, well, I've got to like, I always think about it in terms of like, I come from a world of manufacturing. So, and then sort of backing into the human being. And I think of it like, well, you wouldn't let your machine do this, right? You wouldn't let your machine get all clogged up or whatever it is. But it is, I mean, I think of it like it's like our garbage disposal. So no, I think we need to be more obsessed with it. Maybe that's a whole like another podcast. So first step, you think it's, let's talk about like one or two super easy steps. So if someone is feeling, because fiber can take a little time, right? Like if you go from no fiber to fiber, you can get like, it's a few days of bloating or not feeling great, but eventually like you move things through the system. But if somebody wanted to improve gut health, would you say like fiber is a first step and maybe a couple other great first steps that are like super easy we can do before noon today?
Yeah, I think just following, you know, maybe even just following principles of this Mediterranean diet might be a good place for people to start with. So, you know, if you look at some of the principles of this Mediterranean diet, it's basically trying to eat more plant-based foods. So things like vegetables, fruits, legumes, whole grains and nuts, trying to eat more lean proteins and then healthy fats like olive oil. And then at the same time, trying to limit how much red meat you're consuming, how much processed foods you're consuming, and then not introducing too much salt and sugar into your diet. So I think those are probably principles that, you know, every American could probably incorporate into their diet. And these are things that, you know, these are behavioral changes. So it's not something you're going to do overnight. And maybe just introducing a little bit over time is probably the way to do this in a sustainable fashion.
I like that approach. So what do you recommend about people working with a dietitian if they're struggling?
I think it's a great thing. We are lucky at the University of Michigan. We have some really tremendous nutritionists and dietitians that work with us. And I think our patients really benefit from working with them. You know, whenever we see patients who have inflammatory bowel disease, you know, we're oftentimes asking, would they benefit from seeing our dietitians? Do they think they need some additional support and counseling? So I think it is a tremendous resource if it's available in your community.
Yeah, I think so. And I've seen more and more, there's these apps that I don't know particularly of the quality, but there's a lot of apps where insurance seems to be increasingly covering a nutritionist or dietitian. And I was pleasantly surprised to see that, even for insurance that's like not the best insurance in the world. But I think we have to like re-educate almost. I think we've we've gone through this like consumerist shift in the way we look at our food. And I asked my daughter, she said they never learned the food pyramid in school. I was like, what? Not that that's perfect, but at least let's talk about nutrition. So, okay. So let's talk about research. What's coming up? What are you excited about?
And you're talking about for which condition or just in general?
No, I think in general for gut biome. And I know I'm hearing from you for sure that we need to like figure out a way to get more research into spa patients and their diets. But in general, like in gut biome, what's happening that we should all be excited about?
So there's, I guess if we think about, there's a number of diets that are being looked at in the context of IBD. So there was a study looking at this Mediterranean diet and comparing with something called a specific carbohydrate diet, which is basically trying to avoid certain complex carbohydrates. It's also low in sugar and lactose. And they were looking at if these two diets had any difference in inducing clinical remission and inflammatory markers in Crohn's disease. And they didn't necessarily see any difference between these diets, but because the Mediterranean diet is just an easier diet to follow, that kind of led them to suggest that most patients with Crohn's disease probably could go on a Mediterranean diet, with the caveat that if patients have active inflammation, or especially if they have strictures or narrowing of their intestine, eating a lot of fiber-rich food may not necessarily be the best for them. But for most patients, Mediterranean diet probably is a good place to start. There's also other diets that are being looked at right now. So there's something called CD Treat. And so this is a diet that's looking to try to replicate some of the effects of this, diet called exclusive enteral nutrition. And so I'll back up a little bit. This exclusive enteral nutrition is a liquid diet essentially. And it's been shown in pediatric or kids who have Crohn's disease. It's helpful in inducing remission. The problem is that, especially for kids, this is a liquid formulation, oftentimes has to be given through a tube. And so you can imagine palatability is just a real struggle. And so there's some studies looking at whether the CD Treat, which is whole food based, but it's trying to replicate some of the effects of this exclusive enteral nutrition, might be more beneficial, or at least as beneficial as this exclusive enteral nutrition. And so there's some of these diets that are being studied right now that really have the potential to bring about real change in the community.
No, that's amazing. I mean, you look around in the number of people that just aren't well because of their guts, and it's whether it's ranging from Crohn's to IBS to, and if you're not feeling well, we're just not performing like to where, if you don't, you're feeling well is the number one thing I think that matters, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And meaning, I think I would say that we are fortunate that there is this revived interest in diet in gut health, because like, if you think about like a decade back or like 15 years back, there was almost no research which was going into diet, into these, into any conditions, but specifically GI disorders. And I'm hoping that there is, and the sad part is federal funding has always been very limited in this space, which is kind of the unfortunate part of all this, right? Because again, I think you really need to, and that's what patients want. And I think you need to make sure that you have evidence for what patients want, because sometimes the evidence is what it is. And if we don't do the research, you can't provide them with evidence. You can, and time and again, we know our guesses are generally often not right. We can think that this works, but sometimes it doesn't. I think that is very exciting to see. And
Yeah, you're right. I think there's, thankfully we hope we continue to live in a world where we make decisions that are evidence-based, but even on food, but it's hard. There's a ton of noise, right, around food and the ability to take, and I've been encouraged to some extent, on the side of the world I'm on, which is looking at how some of this research translates into products that are better for people. And there's this encouraging, I think, trend of, companies coming out with probiotic drinks and reduced sugar. And I always dream of the day you can get on the turnpike from, Michigan to the East Coast, and there's a healthy food option along the way, but which they've tried and it's failed. So we know what people want, and it's how do you start to take the research and really get people grounded and like, we need to go back to, I think of it as back to basics, right? When it comes to the gut. And I'm not perfect. And I know like one of my big questions, even for you, is around, I think a lot of us move through life and then we get off track, like with antibiotics or all these other things. But how do we try and continually move toward this state of ease without killing ourselves with the food we put in our mouths? Is interesting. And okay, on that note, I'm gonna ask you the antibiotic question, and then we're gonna talk about like where people can find your work and anything else you'd recommend that people check out as like sort of a beacon of gut health.
For the antibiotics, I think there is obviously a huge impact of antibiotics on gut microbiome, right? Which has been because again, it kills a lot of gut microbiome. But the good thing is for most and people and majority of us, and like the gut microbiome is like is very, very strong community of microbes. So it has impact, but it always will try to go back to its baseline. They have actually done research and shown that if you give people antibiotic and give people probiotics after antibiotic and look at their microbiome, actually the people who didn't get probiotics do the best in terms of maintaining what their baseline microbiome was, because like that's how
You did
resilient
not.
they did. They did the best. They didn't need probiotics because you basically leave your gut alone and you just do what you always do and the gut will take care of it because it's so resilient. It's like a kid, right? When a
Wow.
kid gets bruised, you take care of it. You provide
Right.
it with the support it needs, but in the end the body is so miraculous in healing it that it will. That's not true for everyone, right?
Right.
But it is true for most of us that if that's what happens after a GI infection, right? Like you get horrible GI infection. How do you think you get over it in 5 days or 4 days? Most of us do because our body is just like, no, we'll fight through this. There is a competition, a healthy competition of your healthy bacteria to overcome whatever you face. But on the extreme, there are patients who can't do that on their own because they, whatever the case might be, there might be inflammation, which prevents the growth of healthy bacteria back, or they had back-to-back round of antibiotics, a surgery, an antibiotic, like, a lot of things can disrupt it. In those people, again, I think just go back to healthy eating, do the best you can. And if you're really struggling, work with a dietitian, work with a GI physician who can listen to you and work with you. All I can say is like, I think if I could prescribe a dietitian and a therapist to all of my patients, I probably would, because including myself, because I think we all will be better off if we have those services. Some of it, as Ellen was saying, these are behavioral changes you're making in your life as you're walking through this very, because life is getting increasingly stressful and chaotic, right? So how do you get through this without hurting yourself? And sometimes you don't have time to think about what you're going to eat for dinner, and you're going to make unhealthy choices
Totally.
because I'm sure if I just can't look at this week, I have already done that this week. I don't have to go very far. Right. And I think it's not like I don't know what will hurt and what will not hurt my gut. I know that, but reality is what reality is. And I think realizing that and working towards that goal, however small that step might be, it might just be I'll just start with like, you know, like half a banana a day or one, whatever your favorite fruit is, like that, I'll just eat it once a day. That's it. Still a step in forward direction.
I like
it. I'll just add on to briefly to what Prashant says. You know, with I agree 100%. Our gut microbiome is very resilient. Although just in this particular population that we're talking about, people who have gut inflammation, their microbiome tends to be a little bit less resilient. And these patients are at increased risk for this condition called C. difficile, which is this infection that can be pretty devastating, particularly in the setting of recurrent courses of antibiotics. So it generally is a good idea to try to avoid antibiotics if at all possible. So that would just be my brief little addition to what Prashant said.
I agree.
Yeah, and I would also say that there is a small group of patients where you, for example, I think hospitalized patients, when you're in the hospital and you're requiring systemic antibiotics, sometimes there is evidence that using probiotics in these patients does reduce the risk of C. diff, right? Because again, if you're hospitalized in an ICU or in you're not even walking and chained to a bed, you're of course, like you can't expect your gut microbiome to be healthy at that time. Yeah. Nothing in your body is healthy at that time. Yeah. So you need the help. All the help you can get, right?
Yeah, for sure. Okay, last question, and then we're going to let you roll off into a holiday weekend. What is like your one big hope for the world around the work that can be done in your area?
That's a very, very big question. I think one big, for me, it would be that we as a society take our nutrition and health more seriously and make fundamental changes to where we are and where we need to be, because I don't think we are doing a very good job of taking care of our health then, you know, and it starts with the food you put in your mouth.
Yeah.
I'll say this is something that Prashant and I are interested in, and that's trying to personalize some of these nutritional approaches. We're not there yet, but one of the things that we are particularly interested in is, can we identify potential patients or people who might better respond to one diet versus another, potentially using things like their microbiome or looking at output of microbiome function. And we're not there yet, but that would be something that I would love to see if we can accomplish sometime in the future.
Amazing. All right. On that note, I'm gonna thank you guys for joining us, and we hope you'll come back and give us an update once you've accomplished those lofty goals, or maybe in between. And thank you very much for joining us today. I really appreciate you.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you.
SpondyCast was made possible by donations from the Spondylitis Association of America's individual members and our show's corporate sponsor, AbbVie. Since our founding in 1983, the Spondylitis Association of America has been the face, voice, and leading nationwide nonprofit educating, empowering, and advocating for people living with spondyloarthritis. Through our extensive work with patients, the medical community, and partners, we provide information and resources to help people impacted by the disease live better lives and champion research to find a cure.